I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. A Peruvian Brit named Karina Licorice Quinn has written a novel so full of the spirit of Gabriel Garcia Marquez that I had to stop and double-check that it wasn't he who had actually written it. That novel, The Dust Never Settles, is a marvel, full of wonders and magic, violence and abjection, love and loss, and narrated in a language that feels electric with history. Karina does indeed call on what she refers to as the counter-histories, the untold secondary and tertiary stories of the indigenous pre-colonial people of Peru, specifically Lima, that have been confined to the dust of history. It has been a long time since I've read a novel that cannot seem to contain its own language, but this is the case with The Dust Never Settles. Voices vie for space, speaking in Spanish, Quechua, and English, and descriptions of people and hybridizing culture roll across the page. One World Publishers in the UK, the publisher of two recent Booker Prize winners, has produced as beautiful a physical book as you could imagine. It is a perfect match for this very special novel. Karina and I have a wonderful conversation about belonging in multiple places, in multiple languages, the early influence of Marquez, the need for fiction that can fill the gaps purposefully left by official history, and so much more. While The Dust Never Settles is not yet out in the U.S., you can order it with free shipping from Blackwell's Books in the U.K., making the price a wash. I have links for Karina's novel and all of her recommendations on the website at burnedbybooks.com, where you can also order our new t-shirt. Let's start the show. Welcome back. Today may be the first time you're hearing the name Karina Licorice Quinn, but I'll put a wager down that it won't be the last. A Peruvian Brit who splits her time between London and Lima, Karina began her working life as a children's law barrister before earning a PhD in creative writing at Queen Mary University of London. Her first novel, The Dust Never Settles, is the story of Anaïs, a young pregnant woman who returns to Lima from London to sell her family home. Returning to the Echeverria ancestral home is a catalyst to the unleashing of ghosts. In Lima, at her family's estate, she is confronted with a genealogy of ghosts from her own family line, and startlingly, the spirits of those who worked in the home, built the home, and lived invisible lives all around her family. Karina herself describes the novel as an attempt to bring the counter-narratives of official Peruvian history to life and to dramatize the sins of colonialism, slavery, and injustice that lie beneath the dust of time past. But the plot itself is less than half the story of this remarkable novel. The Dust Never Settles is a tour de force of magical realism in which human time is collapsed into a narrative frenzy of characters and cultures, languages and experiences. Magical realism, a loose term for a form that brings magical elements into a realistic setting, in this novel is an acknowledgement that the things we know to be true, our connections to others across time, can shift our perception of time and place in ways that are beautifully disorienting. In Karina's hands, that disorientation allows oral storytelling to hold its own against book histories. It makes myth live side by side with the so-called official stories of the founding of Peru. And the beauty with which this is accomplished cannot be oversold. Every page of the novel feels like language being reborn. And the rebirth of English, in this case, is with Spanish let loose at its core, with indigenous languages and African interjections enlivening the cataracted staidness of English. Every time Anaïs moves into the focal lens of the story, there are competing stories that demand our attention. that pull us to Spain, to pre-colonial Lima, and back to the present of London. In an age of the minimalist novel in English, Karina has reminded us what we were missing. It is my great pleasure to welcome Karina Licorice Quinn to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased you're here. And this is a novel that absolutely begs to be read aloud. I found myself reading passages to anyone within earshot. I wonder if you'd be willing to read the section of the novel that concerns the fall of Julia Alvarez Yupanqui.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Julia Alvarez Yupanqui did not stop to marvel at the entanglements of genealogies as Alfarrazes bedded Yupanquis, bedded Echeverrias, bedded Ilungas. She was watching instead the arrival of the first Americans trekking across Beringia more than 10,000 years before, and how they meandered south and west and populated the empty continent. She watched too the Polynesian explorers reaching the shores of the Tawantin Suyu in their voyaging canoes, exchanging their chickens for sweet potatoes, and many years later she watched Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki sail west, carried by the Humboldt current, as he aimed to prove that the Incas had been mariners. She saw too the micro-journeys, her parents rushed from the crowded Corralón in the center of Lima to the stretch of dust where they would claim their patch of land and raise four walls of straw matting for a home. From there, her own even shorter journeys appeared, her first steps across the cardboard boxes that served as the floor for the one-room shack, her goings back and forth to school, to the market, and eventually to the yellow house on the hill, where she would start work as an empleada aged 15, her plummet from the second floor window 1 month before her 18th birthday. Yes, she watched her own final journey falling interminably from that unlucky window, smashing repeatedly against the Mayolica. Even this, her own grisly death, did not slow the roving of her all-seeing eyes, which took in the advent of air travel, the flight map scratching across the skies, radiating from glaring cities out to the world's remotest parts. It occurred to Julia that, while living, she had never left Lima, neither by sky nor sea. Her whole life had been spent with her feet on the ground until her death when she had flown. Now she watched the thousands upon thousands of passengers buzzing this way and that at unnatural speed across the heavens. She saw the flights of Professor Leonard Guest backwards and forwards from London to Lima, Lima to London, and how his black-eyed daughter followed in his tracks, Lima to London, London to Lima, always searching for something, a nameless, intangible, just out of reach something, belonging or sanity or restfulness or home. Humanity, she understood, was restless, itchy-footed, irascible, blighted by ennui. Like a child in the womb, humanity kicks at its enclosures. It writhes and wrenches like a tantrum, like a wasp caught in a web. Because across the ether, through every particle of space and time, from Uhu Pacha to Hanach Pacha, a voice reverberates and it says, bear fruit and multiply and swell the earth and subjugate her and be masters over the fish of the sea and the birds of the skies and over all the beasts that move on the earth. And to the sound of this voice, under its compulsion, humanity beats on. For this vagabond race, she felt pity and disgust. At last the time had come, as it does for every risen saint, after millennia spent watching the migrations of man, for Julia Alvarez Yupanqui to be compelled into action. She had risen so as to see. Now she must descend again to intervene. But in what had come before her, Julia found she could not partake. Pizarro and Atahualpa and Fernando II she could not touch. Try as she might to plunge herself into those moments, to go to Bulanda Ilunga's side as she convulsed with fever or to help Hamet Alfaraz cross the Alboran Sea, she was held back as if by an adverse wind. Like the dreamer who runs but never arrives, she struggled towards them but was borne backwards and away. It was only in the events that succeeded her fall that Julia was able to participate, and even then only in the micro. To influence the decisions of presidents, the judgments of high courts, that was not allotted to her. For her were the small things, the daily, the quotidian miracles of little, forgettable people, resurrecting the pets of children, multiplying the pennies in the cup of a beggar, printing the face of Christ on an old widow's toasted bread. Little alleviations in the journeys of the common man. This was the calling of Santa Julia Alvarez Yupanqui.
That is so beautiful. Thank you so much. I had such a difficult time selecting a passage, in part because I found most pages littered with such beauty. But it was Julia's fall, which is such an important generative piece of the novel that I finally lit upon. And her slow motion fall to her death allows her a vision not only of her own life flashing before her eyes, but of the lives of many intertwined generations of lives connected by blood and kin, enslavement and accident, and on and on. The death of one housemaid becomes a catalyst for a stream of memories that will layer the novel with the richness of history. What do you think is the role of a communal shared sense of memories in this novel?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, memory is a central question to the novel, partly filtered through Anaïs trying to come to terms with her own memory. So interestingly, the novel was originally titled Mancherisja, which is a Quechua word for a soul sickness that exists in Andean, many Andean cultures. And it's a soul sickness that arrives essentially through witnessing something terrible or violent happen. So it's a word for trauma. And I think Anaïs, it becomes clear, is traumatized, but the trauma she carries is actually the trauma of the nation that she has been able to see through the ghosts that she's seen since she was young. So one of the questions that was central to me in writing this novel, and which is why I ended up naming it Mancherisja, although we changed the name for publication, was how a nation negotiates its memory, particularly because Peru, of course, is still working out how it thinks about the internal armed conflict that is generally dated from 1980 to 2000. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission delivered their report in 2003, but the nation is still really working out how it looks back on that time, which was a really bloody and terrible, traumatic time, more so for some than others, of course. And so through the novel, although the novel speaks very little about the war, the internal armed conflict itself, one of the things was that I was trying to work out is how we negotiate shared memory, whether it's actually possible. And I see the internal armed conflict in Peru as really having its roots in colonial injustices that have not yet been acknowledged or atoned for. And that's kind of how it all spun out into this kind of epic exploration of the things that have been the amnesia that people engage in. That means that memories become gilded with dishonesty, I suppose, in how we forget the things that we, it's interesting to query who we is, right? But in the things that pushed into oblivion in the official memory of a nation.
Yeah, that's wonderfully described, and how certain traumas through this idea that you're prompting here with a kind of national malaise or sickness or spiritual sickness can be embedded in people who didn't actually experience that, but who understand through a kind of sharing of stories and narratives, but also a kind of understanding of, as you say, the gilding over of histories, have a sense that something is rotten underneath. For me, one of the great pleasures of The Dust Never Settles is its subtle intertextuality. Julia's telescopic vision of Lima's history is wonderfully elusive, I think, of the fall from a hijacked plane of the two protagonists in Rushdie's Satanic Verses. As Gabriel mid-fall becomes the Archangel Gabriel, he begins to weave together the many threads of memory and history that will become the story. Rushdie is borrowing and adapting from the boom-era writers in Latin America who developed a mature usage of magical realism in the 60s and 70s. Did you feel indebted at all to that tradition as you were employing some aspects of that form in your novel?
Definitely. So it's interesting that you mentioned the Satanic Verses, because I haven't read the Satanic Verses to my shame.
I
But
know, not at
Midnight's,
all.
yeah, but Midnight's Children was really influential for me. As I was trying to work out how to weave time and times together in order to tell a lot of different narratives, but to tell them succinctly and powerfully enough that you can cram a lot in, but each one doesn't lose its intensity, because it was important to me that each story, each of the mini stories within the greater story, are memorable and don't get lost. It was Midnight's Children that really showed me how to do that, because I think Rushdie in that novel, and I'm sure in Satanic Verses too, but I haven't read it, creates such compelling, memorable characters so quickly and tells powerful stories so succinctly that somehow feel really, really rich but are done so briefly. So yeah, I owe great debt to Salman Rushdie. And certainly I owe a great debt to the boom writers of magic realism in Latin America. I mean, Gabriel Garcia Marquez was my first introduction to that. So I often tell people how I was schooled in the UK until I was 16, and I always loved studying English. But I studied a lot of the English literary canon and never always admired what I was reading, but never really felt like there was a voice being shown to me that could be anywhere similar to mine as a writer. And it was when I did the IB in New York. I went to the final 2 years of high school in New York, and my English teacher introduced me to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And suddenly a kind of light switched on. I was like, okay, here's a voice that feels like something I might speak in. So absolutely, and Isabel Allende, Laura Esquivel, absolutely, they've all had a massive influence on my work.
Well, I would say that your style is incredibly Marquezian, and so that influence and that you're paying tribute to that connectivity that you found in the text is there, and it's I find that often you find pale comparisons to Marquez, but I feel like you're doing a great justice to his work and the way that you employ magical realism, which is such a loose and baggy term. But I think that the way you're talking about Midnight's Children is helpful in understanding why it's an important style for you, and certainly in Midnight's Children, Rushdie is doing that work of thinking about how an individual can embody all these different communal memories of a nation, and how even that body begins to kind of like split and fray when the kind of deep and untested and untreated wounds of the nation start to sort of come forward in storytelling. And I think that's absolutely here in your novel. The Echeverria house is the wellspring of the novel's memories. Anais has come to sell the ancestral home, but the memories contained within of privilege and servitude and enslavement won't let go so easy. And she's haunted by the many voices of those who built, lived in, and worked in her ancestral home. Why did you decide on a house as the nexus for all these competing memories?
Well, there are sort of two answers to that. And one is the kind of journey that I went on as a writer, and quite a personal one, which is simply that my Peruvian grandparents passed away, and their house in Lima, that for me was probably the house in which I'd been happiest in my life, was put up for sale so that it could be torn down and apartments would be built in its place. This
Oh,
happens kind
no.
of everywhere in Lima. The house was nothing like the house in the novel, but the spirit of the house feels similar to me. So in reflecting on my pain at the idea of this house that really mattered to me being torn down, and indeed it was, I reflected on why houses where one has been happy mean so much, because ultimately, they're just bricks, concrete, mortar, whatever. But there's so much more than that. Gaston Bachelard in The Poetics of Space talks about how physical spaces hold time for us, because we can't live in more than one time at any one time, right? But spaces almost absorb time. He uses the metaphor of them being like alveoli that breathe in time. And that really spoke to me. And then from there, it became this metaphor of house that absorbs and imbibes time. And I think, I mean, we see in the Gothic, right, that the house also serves that function in that houses hold more than the time that is present. They hold also what was past, and in my novel, also what is to come. And then the house, of course, became metaphor for nation in my novel, which I think is quite a natural metaphor in that, you know, if one were to think of nationhood as family, as kind of a kinship network, which of course is problematic in loads of ways, but if one were to think of it as that, then the house which holds that kinship, that family, it kind of seems like an obvious and useful, fruitful metaphor. Particularly when you fold on top all the overhang of the Gothic, right, and sort of hauntedness and basements that contain all the rottenness, and I found it quite useful.
I was actually just going to mention Bachelard, and I think, you know, it perfectly embodies a lot of the work you're doing with the house. I always, ever since reading him in graduate school, I've been drawn to that idea that the sort of garrets and attics of our youth hold in some way these kind of long contained histories. And I love it as a way of thinking through these structures that are so important to us. I was thinking of another literary intertext that I felt very much kind of coursing through your work, which has to do with houses, and that is Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things and her figuration of the history house. In particular, Roy uses the history house as a structure to hold a pre-colonial history that is in some ways destroyed and left only as dust by imperialism and colonialism. Do you envision your novel as a kind of history house, a container for certain untold and untellable histories that have been washed over?
I mean, I'd love to think of it that way. I don't know if I dare claim something so lofty, but I'd love to think of it that way. I mean, so the novel is just now being translated into Spanish, but it's only going to be sold in Spanish in Spain for now. I don't yet have a Latin American publisher, but it's interesting that I wrote in English, but the kind of reader that I had in my head was actually fellow Peruvians. And in particular, fellow Limeñans who may think about the story of Peru in a particular way that has perhaps forgotten the pain that has been pushed to the margins. So it's interesting that I was writing in English, but really thinking of speaking to an audience that would primarily be Hispanophone. The reason I mention this to come back to your question is I'm really looking forward to seeing hopefully how it's received in Peru one day when the Spanish translation is hopefully sold there, because I think it's particularly in that context where this idea of my novel holding all these stories kind of being a history house would be most pertinent, and I'd really love to know how those Peruvian readers react to it. Yeah, hopefully that will happen.
Well, this anticipates a question that I had about the novel being in English, which I guess I felt and in a kind of deep-seated way as I was reading it, that although it is a novel in English, the kind of Spanish teeming throughout, and it's the way that it was speaking of with such intimacy about Peruvian history, made it feel as though it was something more like a novel of world literature, by which I mean where belonging is less fixed, and it is less about a kind of stated national identity of a novel, and more the belief that you can transgress national boundaries to try and understand belonging as more fluid. Is that something that you thought at all about as you were choosing to write it in English, and but to also, you know, bring Spanish to bear in such a strong way?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't necessarily think in particular about how the novel would be categorized, right? So obviously, magic realism was something that was floating around in my head because I was drawing on and influenced by writers like García Márquez, Allende, Rushdie. But certainly this notion of crossing national boundaries, or, you know, imagine these imagined boundaries that national boundaries are, and belonging in more than one place at once, is something that applies to the novel and applies to me, right? So I'm a writer that is in diaspora. And of course, that did actually make finding a publisher for my work kind of tricky, particularly in the UK, because Latin American writing, Latin American identity, Latin American history in the UK is much less recognized in the mainstream. I think a lot of publishers and probably readers, but I hope not, kind of see Latin America as not really relevant to the UK. So in that sense, writing something that is so intimately about Peru, but also about being Peruvian British, it took a little bit of work to convince people that that was something anyone would care about. And I think that's something that a lot of writers who exist transnationally and write transnationally probably encounter. But certainly in the UK, where any reading that takes place in stories that apply outside the UK borders, I think people will be more interested in stuff that's coming out of the old British Empire rather than coming out of Latin America, where I think the reaction is like, how does this apply? Why should I care about this? So that was kind of tricky. But yeah, I think the novel is one that probably would fairly be placed within world literature. And I think it's clearly a transnational piece of work.
Yeah, and that is interesting because as an American reader, of course, Latin America felt instantly important to kind of my reading life, but also to the way I think of American history writ broadly. And so I hadn't put it in my head that that would be a different experience for at least a kind of traditional or even a kind of conservative British reader. But I'm very glad that One World saw fit to see its urgency for the British reader as much as the American. As it concerns your Peruvian Britishness, but also your protagonist, Anais, who is the daughter of, is it an Irish father? Is that right? Am I remembering?
No, so he is English.
He's English, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And then a Peruvian mother, and, you know, she is herself then pregnant with her British partner's child. She worries over what she calls her Celtic complexion, mistaken for a gringa, while regretting that her daughter will be only one quarter Peruvian and estranged from her culture and people, possibly. This anxiety about who gets to properly belong to a place, a nation, a culture, courses through the novel. What did you hope to say about race and belonging with all of its nuances and textured complications in The Dust Never Settles?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure I hoped to say anything because I'm quite nervous about saying anything.
Understandable. Yeah.
But I wanted to open up questions. I think that's what I always hope my writing will do, is just start a conversation. And these conversations are ones that I've been having with myself my whole life. Because, I mean, growing up in Peru, I was always the English girl, and in Britain I was always the Peruvian girl. Which, as a child of from kind of mixed cultural heritage, I'm sure all children who have kind of dual cultures or more go through this crisis of identity, where every time you fly back and forth or every time you move from kind of one family household to the other, you become labeled differently. But it is sort of confusing, especially when you grow up I spent a lot of my childhood in the English Midlands, which is not especially, or wasn't then especially diverse. So you're comparing yourself to all the other children who are just one thing. And you think, okay, gosh, am I some sort of strange hybrid freak? What is happening? And of course, in those days, there was still the attitude that sort of raising children bilingual was confusing for them, and that was a bad thing to do. Gosh. I'm glad that my parents ignored that. But, you know, you can't constantly come across mindsets that tell you that you're odd. And when you're little, you kind of think, yeah, I probably am odd. Now that I'm a grown up, it's fine. But certainly, When I am a mother now, but when I was thinking over years about, you know, will I become a mother? What, I'm married to an English man. So again, one of my big worries was that when I have a child, will they appreciate Peruvian history, culture? Will they speak Spanish? Will I be able to raise them with an appreciation of Peruvianness, whatever that might mean or whatever it means to me? And am I entitled to do that if they're only going to be, you know, notionally a quarter Peruvian? Like, should I be doing that? Particularly now that there's so much angst about, you know, cultural appropriation and
Oh,
things.
yeah.
So all of that sort of was an overhang to my mind. And then in Peru, there are huge questions about, I mean, Peru's culture has been influenced by all the waves of migration that Peru has had through slavery, through indentured workers that were brought from Asia, through various waves of migration from Europe. But I think the contribution that has been made by Asian Peruvians and Afro-Peruvians is often ignored, and the kind of dual heritage that gets emphasized is always the dual heritage of the Spanish and then the Inca, with a focus on the kind of nobility of the Inca, right? Ignoring all of the non-noble, regular indigenous people that existed and continue to exist in Peru. And I hoped that a little bit the novel would just highlight all the contributions that have been made to Peruvian culture and should be acknowledged and admired. A lot of the time, those contributions are whitewashed, and what they've contributed to the culture is lifted up and sort of centered. But the people who have done the contributing and done the inventing and done the work of creating get invisibilized. And I hoped that the novel would do a little bit of work of reminding people of the actual people who did the contributing.
Well, you use a very powerful artifact of memory in the novel of the Luba people, who are from what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. You reference the Lukasa, the memory board that is crucial to Afro-Peruvians who were taken as slaves or were part of various migratory routes. Did you think of this particular artifact as being metaphorically important to the way you were wanting to treat that kind of unseen, as you say, history of Peru?
Yeah, definitely. And I thought, so I was quite nervous about including the Lukasa because I went to Lima to do archival research on, among other things, slavery in Peru, and looked through so many old manuscripts, including sort of lists of people that were brought in enslavement and where they had come from. But there was no, beside these sort of lists and numbers of people whose bodies are being treated as commodities, there was nothing of narrative or of substance to tell me about what their lives were like before they came over. The cultural things, stories, you know, practices that they brought with them. And so I had to do quite a lot of digging to find something that would exemplify the kinds of practices and cultures that these people would have come from. And eventually I came across the Lukasa. It was important to me to particularize and be very specific about the cultures that would have been brought over because they have been invisibilized and forgotten. And so I thought I need something really concrete from at least one culture that I can use. And then the Lukasa, of course, as soon as I came across it and learned about what this practice is, I thought, gosh, this is really powerful as a metaphor for creating memory and retaining memory and passing memory on. So I see it as quite a central organizing metaphor for the novel, even though it doesn't take up much of the novel. And I actually have an article in which I speak a little bit about the Lukasa coming out in the Journal of Transatlantic Studies next year.
Oh, fabulous. I was struck by it as a as quite a powerful metaphor and perhaps a competing one to the house, because obviously this is, you know, the Afro-Peruvian folks in your novel would not have had access to live in an estate yeah. or even a, you know, a fixed house like that. And so the way that you have an architecture that can hold memories changes and becomes more sort of micro, but still very powerful and still evocative and something that can be added to by generations and then traced back. So I found it to be a very powerful competing narrative.
Yeah, I love that interpretation. And I guess also an obvious comparison between the two is the sort of selfishness of a house, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas the selflessness or the kind of service that the Lucase is about serving the community and giving back and holding memory, but holding memory for everyone rather than erecting walls that hold memory for a select few and exclude everyone else. Yeah. Certainly the walls of the house, right? The walls and the gates and the fences of the house are a really important symbol in the novel of exclusion and privilege and oppression through exclusion, which of course the Lucasa memory board is not like that at all. It's to be shared.
So yeah, one is a closed door and one is a very open door. I like the way you formulate that. So the dialogue of the novel, as I mentioned, is peppered with Spanish, interwoven and supplemented with dialects and traces of indigenous languages. And indeed, the novel itself marks its chapters in alternating Spanish and English numbers. Did writing the book help you better understand the relationship between language and belonging to multiple communities, as both you and Anaïs do?
I think the novel more just expresses the understanding I already have. I actually wish it had more Spanish in, but I kind of was aware in writing it that if it was too infused with Spanish, at some point it probably entirely excludes the monolingual Anglophone reader. So I did have that in my mind. At some point in my life, I'd love to write a completely Spanglish novel and have it published. I mean, my experience of language my whole life has been moving between Spanish and English and indeed speaking in both at the same time. And so it's important for my work to reflect that as a reflection of my own voice inside my head and my own voice when I move through the world. The inclusion of mainly Quechua and smatterings of other indigenous languages was a conscious decision for me because I thought it was important to have that representation there. So much to my shame, I don't really speak Quechua. I feel that I should, and I'm trying my best to learn in the minimal time that I have available to me. But I thought if I'm writing a novel that is really quite explicitly politically opening up conversation about oppression of indigenous peoples and the wrongs of colonialism that haven't been acknowledged, if there is no Quechua in this novel, that is going to be a problem. And so I really did my best learning Quechua that would be relevant and including it. I would love it if there were more, but I don't speak good enough Quechua to do it. I'll try in the future. Go on.
No, well, I was going to say that it did strike me as a political decision to leave the Spanish and Quechua untranslated. I mean, there's a glossary, but in the moment, it's untranslated, and you know, for a monolingual reader, it then requires a kind of contextualization that is very easily done, but it also is a reminder you are not necessarily the audience for this particular moment in the novel. And I feel like that's, you know, there aren't that many novels still that do that. And even though it's become more prominent, I think it was certainly a conscious decision on your part and had to be one, I'm sure, in conversation with the publisher. Were you very conscious about deciding that, or was it just the natural way that you wrote it?
Yeah, so I was really influenced by Doris Summers' notion of slaps and embraces in the book. Oh, what is the title of it now? Something like Proceed with Caution, when engaging minority writing in the Americas or something like that. I've probably completely butchered that title, but in that book, Summer talks about texts which consciously push the reader away a little and remind the reader, you are not the reader here. And I spent quite a lot of time thinking about who the narrator was speaking to. And certainly the narrator isn't really speaking to the Anglophone Brit, even though that I knew was going to be my first audience, because it would probably be published first here in English, not in translation, and it would be the Brit who would read it first. As I said earlier, really in my head, I was sort of talking to Lemenian Peruvians, probably privileged Lemenian Peruvians with primarily European heritage. That's really who I was in conversation with in notionally in my head. And so the Anglophone Brit, the Anglophone reader anywhere, I feel like that pushing away through the inclusion of the Spanish and not translating it immediately, not italicizing it and therefore othering the language, which is a conversation I had with my publisher, there is that pushing away that happens. I actually, and that for me was conscious and intentional, partly because that's the pushing away that my mother and my sister and I experienced in the English Midlands. You know, there was xenophobia and we were quite often told to stop speaking in Spanish in public in quite aggressive terms. And so for me, sharing that experience with the reader of saying, here's how it feels to be pushed away a little. How does that feel to you was important. But I also wanted there to be a welcoming back in, which is why I ultimately accepted to put the glossary in the back. I originally wasn't sure about the idea. And then I thought, well, actually, if I'm pushing the reader away a little, let me then extend a hand of friendship through the glossary again. But accessing the glossary requires some effort on the reader's part. You know, they have to intentionally go there. They have to flick the pages. They have to use their memory to retain the information. So there's that kind of give and take, which I think is nice. And the same idea as what Doris Summer speaks about, right, of kind of slaps and embraces. You embrace and then you push away. You embrace and push away. And there's that nice negotiation between text and reader.
Yeah, and that particular sort of form of the multilingualism then is in perfect concert with the actual sort of plot and narrative of the novel. So I think it's it endorses what the novel is already trying to do. Before we leave you, I was wondering if we might hear some of your reading recommendations. Can you tell us what you've been reading recently that you really enjoy? And are there forthcoming books that you might flag for us ahead of their publication?
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the most exciting books that I have read this year, it came out earlier this year in the UK, and I think it's also out in the States, is called Open Water by Caleb Azuma Nelson. Set in London, it's an exploration of, so many amazing themes, but race, love, art, belonging. And what's particularly exciting about it is that it does some really interesting stuff with the novel form. Reading it feels like reading poetry, but it is a novel. But then the kind of episodic and really pensive way themes are tackled almost feels like nonfiction. So it's really cool, a really cool book.
I'm excited about it.
Oh, it's brilliant. I really recommend it. I've put it on my reading list for my students. And it also helps that Caleb Azuma Nelson is a great person too.
I love that.
Yeah, a great writer and a great person. Really nice guy. I'm currently reading One Sky Day by Leonie Ross. I haven't finished it. It's a work of magic realism that is Caribbean in spirit rather than kind of Hispanic American. I'm loving it. It is kind of a beautiful example of kind of whimsical and unsettling magic realism that uses lovely weird magical moments that are also powerful metaphors for different kinds of human experience and politics too. So yeah, I really recommend One Sky Day by Leonie Ross. A poetry collection that came out this year by a Mexican-British writer. It's a debut poetry collection. The poet is Maya Elsner. She's actually doing doing an MFA in the States at the moment. I think she's going to be huge. It's called Overrun by Wild Boars, published by a small press in the UK called Flip Die that have done great work at diversifying publishing and getting really amazing new names out into the world. Her writing is just, I mean, breathtakingly good. And she explores identity, belonging, migration. She has, as I said, Mexican, British, Jewish heritage. And she kind of explores all of the impact of all of those on her and her poems. Just amazing. And then in nonfiction, When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut.
Oh, I can't wait to get that.
Yeah, it's really amazing. reading each essay, you just end each one completely breathless and think, I have learned so much, and it's so much that I've now forgotten it. I need to start again. So I'm going through it quite slowly, because every time I finish an essay, I then have to start it again. I really admire the way Labatut kind of transitions. I find as a writer, transitions are hard, transitioning between times and places and scenes and topics. And these essays just are exemplary in doing that and making it feel so natural, taking loads of notes as I read.
Is it not fiction? It's essay then. I'd thought it was a sort of pastiche novel.
That may be true.
I don't have it in my hands yet, so you would be much more familiar than I would.
I think there's probably fiction. It's been sold as fiction, so okay. I think it probably is fictionalized, but they read like essays each chapter.
Oh, interesting.
And I'd be interested to sit down and compare what is being said with what historical sources say, because when you read it, it reads as historical nonfiction. But it may be that when I sit down and actually look at what is true and what isn't, it's actually completely fictionalized. I don't know. We'll see. Right now, I'm kind of just enjoying the journey.
Well, that makes it more exciting rather than less exciting, I think, to have that kind of wonderful confusion of genres. That's my favorite kind of novel.
Yeah, this question of sort of, as a writer, what you do with history and what you do with when you write in between, in the spaces in between historical fact, is an interesting one. Because, another way of interpreting my novel is that it's a historical novel. But of course, I've had to do a lot of making up of things in the gaps that exist in the archive. So it's an interesting question. At what point something that draws on history but fictionalizes the gaps in between, when do we move from kind of history to fiction? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, and I wonder if a better way to actually talk about so-called official histories is that they make up things to fit the gaps and the transitions, but we never dare to speak of history in those terms. But that might give fiction its proper place as a parallel and equally important discourse of what has happened in the past. And certainly that's what your novel feels like as a reader.
Yeah, I mean, on Labatut's book. So it's interesting because I'm looking at the back and it says, clearly says fiction. And of course, shortlisted for the 2021 International Booker Prize. But when I picked it up in the bookshop, it was on a table with nonfiction.
Oh, fascinating.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting one.
Well, these are amazing. And I love the fact that except for the last, I don't know any of them, which is going to make for great reading, which is exactly what I selfishly hope for these things. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun. Thank you. I'm honored that you asked me.
Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Well, that's all from me today. My great thanks to Karina Licorice Quinn, whose novel The Dust Never Settles is linked to on our website at burnedbybooks.com, where you can find links to all Karina's wonderful recommendations, as well as all of our previous episodes and book suggestions. If you're a regular listener and might enjoy some podcast merch, our first ever Burned by Books t-shirt is available for sale at the website and in the bio section of our Instagram page. I am always wearing at least two of them under my regular clothes, and you should too. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.